welcome to the first ever episode of the In Their Own League podcast. I'm Bea Garner, the editor and founder of In Their Own League, and joining me on this episode for the discussion about the male gaze theory is two of our writers, Kate Boyle and Stephen Palmer. For those who aren't aware of the male gaze theory, I would just give you a quick short history lesson. The male gaze is the act of depicting women and the world from a masculine heterosexual perspective that presents women as sex objects. The film critic Laura Mulvey coined the term in her 1975 essay entitled Visual Pleasure and Narrative Cinema. In our discussion, we'll be breaking down what the male gaze is and also discussing whether it is still something that is relevant in today's climate. Without any further ado, let's get into our discussion. Hi everyone, it's Bea back again here with the In Their Own League podcast, and I'm joined by two of our special league members. I'm going to get you guys to introduce yourselves. Who would like to go first?
Can I say ladies first? Is that allowed?
Yeah. I guess I'm Kate. Do I need any other intro than that?
No, that was perfect. That was great. Yeah, no. So, Kate, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Excited to be on the first ever official In Their Own League podcast.
Of course, yeah, it's awesome.
Yay! yes, we've got our male gaze expert here as well. How are you doing?
Because I haven't owned some eyes.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to imply. How are you doing today?
I'm great, thank you, Bea.
Yeah, and we're both sort of excited to tackle one of the biggest subjects we could ever start off with today.
Let's tackle one of the pillars of feminist film theory, shall we? So it can only be uphill from here.
I did think it was rather ambitious for a first podcast, but you know, hey, you got to start off big, haven't we? So, the male gaze. Oh, the dreaded male gaze. Who wants to sort of unpick this with me? I was just going to say, let's try and define it in our own words. I mean, Kate, when I say the male gaze, what's your first sort of reaction?
For me, it's when you have a female character in a film or any media, really, but just for us specifically in film, that is either over-sexualized or specifically in a view that a heterosexual male would want in a film or what they're supposed to want in a film. Odd camera angles, just weird things like that. For me, that's what I think of.
And is there any glaring examples that spring to mind?
For me, is anything Zack Snyder does to Wonder Woman or the Amazons.
Yes. I can't remember who put it up. There was a tweet. Was it last year when the Justice League movie came out? And it was like a comparison between Patty Jenkins' like take on the Amazons and then Zack's sort of depiction of them. And they were wearing, you know, a lot less clothes in the Justice League movie.
Yeah, my mother's an like OG original Wonder Woman fan and loved the Wonder Woman movie. But then when Justice League came out, she's just been like so upset. And like, I hear about it all the time. And she's a like hardcore feminist as well. And so the Wonder Woman movie gave her so much. She's like, oh, yay, finally, a real movie. And then Zack Snyder ruined it for her. And so I get to hear about it all the time, anytime she visits.
Well, she sounds wonderful. I think we should have her on the podcast one of these.
She'd love it. Anytime you talk about Wonder Woman, she'll hop right on.
Noted. We're doing a special dedicated Wonder Woman episode for your mother.
And as a comic book fan, I'm all for that. Bring her on. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What does the male gaze mean to you, our token man of the episode?
I'd have written a token anything before, but there we go. All right. So I'm absolutely agree with what Kate says. I think there's a little bit more to it. So the example that I would give would be to help describe it would be and the complexities around it would be Basic Instinct, right? Not a great movie, but the famous scene with Sharon Stone and the interrogation room. Okay, so what we have to look at it, we have to look at it in three and maybe these days in four different ways. We have to look at what the script's trying to say, what the director's trying to show, and how the audience are reacting to it. And furthermore, there's a little complication in the modern IT world as well. So in terms of the script, that famous scene is meant to be showing actually Sharon Stone's character, Catherine, whatever her name is meant to be very powerful. Yeah. There's a bunch of sweaty old men around that are looking but she's got the absolute power on them. And the uncrossing of her legs is meant to show the power that she has over them. However, if we look at it from a directorial point of view, that decision to show that moment and not just suggest it or do it in another way is very much what the male gaze is about. This is about, hey, look, there's a sexy woman and we're trying to show it. But you could have filmed that in a completely different way and kept the power. And so again, the third item is how the audience are viewing it, and we're viewing it in a very salacious, head-on kind of way. And it doesn't matter if you're a heterosexual man or a gay man or a gay woman or a straight woman, you are absolutely implicit in that aspect. We take it a bit further, because I'm pretty sure when Paul Verhoeven shot it, he wasn't expecting it to become the king of clickbait on YouTube videos and websites, where now we can pause things to every frame and it says the most paused scenes of all time. So actually it's become something bigger than the film itself, and as an example of male gaze outside of film as well, if that makes sense. So that scene in itself, you know, it kind of describes those three and a half different ways of looking at the male gaze. Does that make sense to everybody?
Makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah.
I haven't actually seen the film, but I know that scene. It's one of those things that male directors try and portray women in a certain way to make out that they're strong and that they're complex characters, but it's kind of devaluing them by objectifying them and saying that they're only strong because they're so attractive and they have this power over men not because of their intelligence or, you know, their wit or anything like that. It's because of how they look, and you've got to think about what kind of message that's putting out to women and especially young girls. I hope no young girls are watching Basic Instinct. I mean, but you know what I mean. Where it's like, I think in terms of like how certain female superheroes are depicted, especially on the posters, where it's like the shown from on toward the back, so you see much of their lovely rear end, and then you have
they're naturally posed to show a maximum bum and boobs, right?
Yeah,
yeah, it's either from the back or on the ground facing up, so there's a huge silhouette of their chest, or it looks much bigger than it is.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of Black Widow in the first Avengers movie. And then, you know, you have all the guys, you know, Hawkeye shooting stuff up in the air. You've got the Hulk being hulky. They're all action, and then she's there like, ooh, look at me. I'm sort of posing. I could be posing for, like, I don't know, advert for perfume more. I'm not a powerful superhero.
Well, she legitimately has no powers. She has certain set of skills, don't get me wrong.
Yeah,
but it is kind of interesting that she's woefully underpowered compared to even Hawkeye. who's probably the person who's least served well by those films. But
at least he's depicted. I mean, you know, he doesn't have any superpowers, and he's depicted as this great action guy who's shooting arrows and stuff. Like, come on, you know.
Absolutely.
And I feel like that's something they do with female characters is, especially if they have a skill, like Black Widow is a super spy, but they have to make her super sexy to make her, like, quote unquote, work. Like they did that with Megan Fox in the Transformers movies, where she was wearing almost nothing, but she was really good at cars. So they had to make her look more feminine because, you know, good looking women can't work on cars and wear clothes.
Oh, God, yes. Oh, so... Yeah. Those are some movies to unpack, aren't they? The Transformers films.
And then they had to replace her with a Victoria's Secret model who also ran around in no clothing.
And this is...
Can we just make sure Michael Bay Transformer movies, because the original animated movie is a work of genius. So we just want to, to push that one out.
And Bumblebee was pretty good. You know?
Yeah, Bumblebee was good.
That was completely like a interesting step in a different direction that they did. It was still Transformers, but you know, it actually had a story that I could follow. Whereas the other movies, I cannot tell you what went on in any of them, and I've seen them more times than I should have done.
As a childhood Transformers fan, I've never more disappointed than seeing the first Michael Bay. I couldn't understand what was going on. That everything was overly complicated in terms of the CGI and how the robots went together. And I mean, yeah, they're all got, I think we assume the robots are all men, by the way. so it's an interesting one for this, but I've never been so disappointed as when I saw that movie.
One of the Decepticons is female, Starfire, I think.
Right, yeah. I think there
with
is...
a plain one.
There is a... Yes, and how she's depicted. Is she... She's evil, isn't she?
She is. So, stealthy and evil.
So the only female robot character is evil. What is up with that? But I think there is actually a female... I don't know what... there are female...
Autobot.
Yeah, there is in the animated series. Is that right? Mm-hmm. So I think they said that the reason they didn't put them in the movie was because they didn't think the audience would be able to... they didn't think the audience would be able to believe that there could be female robots.
Bringing my full nerd with us. I think in the Beast Wars, one of these early CGI animated things, one of the robots was a female, I'm pretty certain, and was feminine. But I just kind of assumed they wouldn't have genders.
They're
a completely different sort of life form, and the concept of having genders to procreate would be somewhat irrelevant because they don't get up to any of that shenanigans. Therefore, they just are what they are. So I think actually having a Starfire kind of... was that her name, do you say?
Yeah, I think
the female one. Yeah, having one of them sounds somewhat pointless to me, but never mind.
Yeah, it does sound really odd. I mean... we're getting off track here anyway. I mean, this is what happens whenever Transformers is like brought up into any subject conversation. It all goes like, you know, we end up sort of trying to debate what they were trying to achieve for those films. But yes, Megan Fox's character in that movie is very problematic.
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking of other examples as well. If we go back to, you know, we've discussed quite, well, I suppose, contemporary films, but the male gaze has really been there since the birth of cinema. I mean, if we look at how, you know, in the 1920s, how women were depicted as vamps and, you know, I'm thinking of... you know, how the studio system really sort of exploited actresses on based on their looks and appearance, and you know what they did in terms of to re- basically, like with Marilyn Monroe, was transform her into this sex symbol. And
Yeah, they did the same with Lauren Bacall. They said her voice was too nasally and high-pitched, and they told her to go away and come back when she learned how to speak in a more pleasant way. And that's where she went with a vocal coach, and she learned how to do her deep, like, sultry voice, which she's famous for.
I know, and isn't it a case that, like, she was really young when she was, like, starring alongside actors who were well into the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, Katharine Hepburn, too. She was in her teens, and she was paired up with Spencer Tracy, and he's in his 40s or 50s.
Yeah, I mean, that was pretty much de rigueur at the time, wasn't it? Mm. Which I guess is where you're coming from. I'm not entirely sure that's covered in male gaze. That's more about just darn bad treatment of females in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, that's true. But it is kind of in the way that how women have a shelf life and are sort of depicted based on their looks and their appearance, and, you know, they get to a certain age and then they're not seen as attractive anymore, so we see less of them on the big screen. I'm just thinking of, like, how many actors there are who are still in, you know, in their 60s and 70s who are working, but then
if you're not Helen Mirren, I think be pretty lonely, aren't you? and sort of the world that I normally sort of work in, Asian cinema, it's even worse. Yeah, I mean, once you, unless you're one of the special few, after 30 in Korean film, you might as well not exist anymore. There are a few exceptions, as always, but they're very, you know, there's always a new pretty young thing that can come from some pop group or from some manufactured world that can fill the next film, and Hollywood's not been too dissimilar. I guess the transition, the trajectory would be, you know, you're a young thing in Hollywood, and you might get to make a couple of indie films or TV move, and then you end up guest starring on Columbo in your 60s, and that's about it. I'd like to think things are changing. But I think every time we bring notice to it, and, you know, Helen Mirren, I sort of jokingly said Helen Mirren, Emma Thompson, people like that are getting some play, but I still think they're exception rather than the rule when we look at the absolute output of Western cinema.
And you, even the way we talk about them is different. Like Helen Mirren, oh my gosh, she looks fabulous for, you know, 60, 70 years old, but they never say that about men, and men can still get leading roles. Like Sean Connery was, what, 50, 60 when he got Bond? He's 50 years old. And it was just like, yeah, he's normal. He's good looking, even though he's quote unquote old. And then, but the women in those films are always 19, 20 years old. And they would have never casted somebody, a female that was that old for a leading role. But you never hear anybody talk about men like, oh, he looks good for 50, except for Paul Rudd. We're always going to talk about how he doesn't age. But
go back to something like Cary Grant. Yeah, yeah. And Cary Grant, mate, you know, he was starring in all those films, his most successful films, with sexy young ladies on his arm when he was, and he probably didn't really make it till his 40s.
Yeah, Charade, I think he was 50, and Audrey Hepburn was in her 20s.
Yeah. And as a male, that does appeal, all right? I'm going to be honest with you. It doesn't make it right, but that's the fantasy that it's kind of supporting, isn't it?
Of course. I mean, these films that are, you know, are made for a male audience in mind, they're not made really necessarily for myself and Kate, you know. And it's funny because, you know, we do make up half of the population after all.
Actually, you make 51% of the world's population. There are more women than men in the world. So this is never made any sense. But it is, it's about who actually goes to the cinema, and I guess a historical thing about who's got the money to go, and therefore will men go more likely on their own or with groups, or will they be taking their girlfriend along with them? You know, I don't agree necessarily with those things I've just said, but there must be something going on in people's heads. There must be something where a world where the remake of Ocean's 11, more people go to saw that than Ocean's 8. Why is that? Is it about the quality of the film? I don't know. And then a bit of it is things like Ocean's 8 and Hustlers and things like that that make this big deal about it, all female cast, female directors or not, you know, whatever. Does it do a disservice by bringing notice to that in such a way, by reacting completely, you know, to switch genders on things? Is that the right thing to do? I'm not so sure.
I think yes and no. I mean, because if you look at kind of on the opposite with other groups like LGBT groups or trans actors and actors with disabilities, what we consider a successful role for them in a film is when they're not mentioned, when they're not, they don't make a big deal about it. They're just in the film normally as it should be. And where, and like in Assassination Nation, it was great. I'm failing to think of other films, but we considered a good job in a film when other groups are in the film and it's not, they don't make a big deal out of it. Look, this is a selling point where they're just in the film naturally. But with women, I feel like it's, they do want, like, this is an all female film and it's kind of a selling point. And so it's different how we kind of view it. And I think there's always going to be that group that will just completely ignore it simply for the fact because they don't want it to be like PC or they get mad about that. And so it's, I don't know, it's just like a weird thing. I mean, I'm all for female films. I love to go see them, but sometimes the advertising kind of puts me off a little bit. Because it seems like they want to sell more tickets by, like, look, we included these women. Look how awesome we are.
But also, don't you think the advertiser, someone says, hey, look, guys, we've got a film with eight women instead of one.
Yeah.
I think advertising and marketing are probably the further behind than the actual filmmaker sometimes.
Yeah. I think that there's definitely, we've come a long way. Especially in terms of like the James Bond films are a classic example, but I do feel like there's certain genres which are still being dominated by the male gaze, especially action films, and I would almost say as well as like horror films.
We've
just done the 31 Days of Horror countdown, which you can head over to our website, intheirownleague.com, and you can see all the 31 films that were horror films directed by women. So
nice segue, B. Nice.
Thank you. a lot of even those films still adopt the same sort of male gaze type of thing, where I think it's The Slumber Party Massacre is a great example of a film which, you know, features women at a slumber party, not wearing very much. Even though those women are resourceful and they do fight off the bad guy and some of them do survive, they are still, how they're depicted on screen is still catering to a male audience. And that's, you know, I'm not saying that horror films are, you know, not every female is going to flock to see a horror film. I think a lot of us don't necessarily like that genre, but
it's kind of ironic. It was okay, I'm interrupting you, but it's kind of ironic though, isn't it, that you're absolutely right. And, you know, it will be a real disappointment to me if you tell me slumber parties aren't really full of girls in their slits having pillow fights, but that's another thing altogether. No, in all seriousness, you're absolutely right. There's a sexualization of women in those films, both as victims and as what they're wearing. And if they dare have sex, well, that's the end of them. Mm. But on the other hand, how many horror films can you name where actually the whole final girl syndrome, I guess, is that the woman is usually the heroine. She usually is the resourceful one. She usually is the one that survives towards the end of the film. I've just been through my own, and I must, out of 31 films I watched, I reckon 25 of the films had a strong female lead who actually won at the end of the day. The tragedy is that in 20 of those films, she at least spent 5 minutes just in her bra. Yeah,
yeah.
there's a real sort of tension between the fact that actually they're really quite empowering films, but what the male gaze does is it sexualizes them, and almost doesn't undercut it, but just sort of says, "Hey, this girl's really cool, and isn't she sexy as well?" Whereas I suspect to most horror fans, they're probably quite interested in just her slashing some bloke up rather than whether she's wearing a bra or not.
Ready or Not was a good example of a final girl film where they don't really over-sexualize her. She's in her wedding dress for most of it, but she's also wearing Chucks and like Converse shoes and is running around. So,
yeah, this is the thing. I always find this when I see women in high heel shoes, like running around. I mean, come on. Like, hello, Jurassic World, when she's running away from a T-Rex in high heels. No.
That would not be my choice of footwear running from dinosaurs.
No,
I don't understand. I don't understand high heels. Full stop. But let alone as a method of getting around. Just, I mean, I watch people stumble around on them in the real world, and how you could use them to get away from a serial killer or a T-Rex or even drive, frankly, is beyond me. So that is a trope which I find really weird. But of course, why are they wearing high heels? Because it stretches the leg and makes their legs look good. And again, that's what. It's all about what we're talking about, yeah.
Invented them.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Even with Jurassic World, that when the criticism came out that she was running around in high heels, they made a big point of saying that, you know, Bryce Dallas Howard really did that, and look how awesome she was because she was able to do this whole movie in heels, and she didn't break her ankle. Look at her, she's so awesome for this. Like, we didn't put her in harm's way or make a bad footwear decision. Like, it was, they tried to turn around and say, look, this is a good thing. Look how awesome she is and strong.
But her character, the way her character is depicted in that film is very unflattering because she's very uptight, and she is Chris Pratt's character, he's the laid back one, he's the one that we root for, and we almost think like, oh, why is he go, you know, why did those that uptight, you know, woman get with him, is she so bitchy and stuff? And I think that's kind of comes into how female characters are written in this way. It's like, if you're a career woman, you have to be this cold-hearted, uptight, you know, Devil Wears Prada type. I'm impressed that she did manage to do all of that running around in high heels. That's, you know, that's pretty awesome considering I always end up twisting my ankle. So I'm kind of jealous in a way. But compared to his outfit and what he's wearing and how he's depicted, I just remember her wearing that really weird white suit. And then it gets progressively ripped and more ripped and
see-through.
Yes. Oh, yes. But, you know, I've got... I love her as an actress. I think she's really good. And I think she did well with what she had. And the fact, like I said, the fact that she managed to do all that running in those shoes is very impressive. But... oh...
But she didn't have to. There is no story reason for her to have to do that. There's no character reason for her to have to do that. She could have been quite easily wearing, maybe not sneakers, but a set of flat shoes, and everything about her character would have remained the same. She would have been no less attractive, should have been no less whatever adjective you want to put against her. Actually, what you've done, you've put her in harm's way, frankly. Yeah, so what Kate said, that's great. So we put somebody in harm's way. You know, if this was a child doing this, there'd be, there'd be someone protecting them against that. Or if you're an animal, there'd be an organisation stopping that happening. So I don't know. Maybe I'm overreacting, but
no, I think that's a very good point. I mean, I would personally thought that she was going to take the shoe off and like throw it at the T-Rex, maybe use it as a weapon.
I would have.
Exactly. This was my thought when I was watching the movie. I was like, come on, take it off, stab it. I don't know. Do something with it.
A high heel in the eye. That's
Yeah, exactly.
maybe a different sort of film, but yeah.
Yeah. Do we feel that the male gaze is still really something that is dominating the film industry, and will we ever reach a point where, well, I don't think it's ever going to go away, but do we think it's ever going to not be so, what's the right word,
prevalent?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's getting better, like especially in specific drama genres. It's appearing less and less. Like one that it used to be incredibly common but isn't quite so much is Westerns. I mean, they don't make a ton of Westerns, but it used to be that John Wayne chasing around Maureen O'Hara while she's, you know, losing clothes, being tarred and feathered, and then like spanks her in front of the entire cast was acceptable. But now you see a lot of stronger women in Westerns. They're not as sexualized. There isn't just a lot of that in Westerns anymore. It's more about survival.
They don't have to be the saloon prostitute anymore.
No. So I think that genre specifically has gone a long way. But other ones like the whole comic book movies, action movies, horror movies, I think still have a long way to go.
Yeah, I mean, I think Captain Marvel tried to do something different in the sense that Brie Larson's character is pretty much head to toe covered. I think there's other things wrong with the Captain Marvel movie in terms of Mary suing her or maybe going completely in the other direction. But that was kind of interesting. That was very different in terms of the visual approach. And not to say that she's still not filmed bum first, tits out, that kind of thing. But I think they were trying. I think there's a move in that direction. But this is as old as any kind of creative subject is. It's not just film, is it? This exists in this art. Exists in art. And the only thing I would say is that, I mean, Kate was quite right at the beginning as she talked about the viewpoint of the heterosexual male. I think there's very much a male gaze in the homosexual male. I mean, Michelangelo's David, right? That's an example of the male gaze on the male as well. Mm. And quite a lot of films, I don't want to call them gay films because that's wrong, but sort of male homosexual films also do tend to have a leery eye over their subject matter. It's not women in their case, but I think it's not just a women thing.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. I think this is something that the male gaze theory almost completely forgets about, this, you know, about queer cinema and LGBTQ cinema and all that aspect of it. And doesn't really address that. Like, you know, sometimes the reason that and also doesn't really go into how the audience, it's almost like the audience is just passive, but there is an active audience. We're not just passive observers, we're not just passive voyeurs, we are also engaging with the movie and discussing it and challenging it as well. So it's not like we're just, you know, subconsciously just absorbing this. And I think perhaps maybe at the time that Laura Mulvey was writing, that was something that maybe, you know, was more of a thing, because obviously the internet now has given us, especially aspiring critics like ourselves, more of a voice and more of a platform to discuss films. And through this, that we now are observing, you know, we were observing these films in a different way to how it was in the 1970s and the 60s and the 50s, where I think the male gaze was probably at its peak, really. And
and we're also consuming it differently. Again, this is why I brought in that opening, sort of my opening example of Basic Instinct is, you know, that film was almost certainly designed to be shown at the cinema. Right, VHS was a thing, certainly rental VHS and probably early DVD when that film came out. But really, films up to that point were, you probably saw it at the cinema on the big screen, and you probably didn't see it again until it came back to the big screen, or maybe it was on TV, but TVs were a very different beast than they are now. Now the way we consume it on our big 50-inch TVs, on the internet, on Blu-ray, on streaming services, on YouTube, on all this, do you know what I mean? And so our ability to consume it, to consume clips of it. So again, it's about this. This is the tease. This is the way we can compress a movie into 5 minutes. The power of the trailer. You know, the trailer used to be a special thing that used to go and see at the cinema, and that's when all this, quite a lot of this stuff is all focused into. You know, the Megan Fox over the engine of the car. That's probably almost certainly in the trailer, because that's where we're trying to get people at. Now, those trailers are not part of that special cinema experience. They're part of, I can't watch a video on YouTube without getting a blooming trailer coming up to me or something like that. I can't even start Netflix up without the trailer or something coming. Do you know what I mean? So our consumption, the way it's forced into our faces, actually could get worse.
Do we feel like now that there is more to do with like Instagram and how, you know, the selfie is used, and how it's almost got to a point that the male gaze is now more of a pressing matter than it was, 15 years ago? Is it a case of, I just think, you know, I see, so I don't go on Instagram because I'm old, I don't get it. I say I'm old, but I don't like this idea of how, you know, you have filters and, you know, it's about taking photos of yourself, and I just think, why? I don't want to take photos of myself. I never get that appeal. But are we now sort of, in order to get likes and in order to get people's attentions, we have to be more risque? And is that something that's now been, that filmmakers are going to adopt more?
Well, and what was considered kind of scandalous 20 years ago is like PG now. So I feel like that could be a bigger problem as well, is what's acceptable to be shown in a PG-13 movie or a PG movie is much different than it used to be. So they used to get away with like male gaze kind of focused like camera angles and ads back then, and it was, you know, people fully covered, but it just was positioned just the right way to show like outlines of women and things like that. But now, I mean, you can show pretty much a naked woman with nothing but like a sheet covering her in a PG movie. So it's, I know, it's kind of like,
yeah, and there's probably rules, aren't there? Or you can have one breast but two swear words or something like that. There's probably a list set up somewhere. I mean, what worries me, B, is what you just spoke about, is that sometimes there's maybe a generation of young women that aren't helping themselves, and that Instagram culture actually works against them. Yes, I know it can be just like, oh, I'm empowered, I've got this makeup to look the way I want to look, and the fact that everyone starts to look the same, I actually find quite worrying, you know, with filters and career makeup, everyone starts to look exactly the same with the same features, and you think, what the hell's going on here? But yeah, but that would concern me, because it's almost a reactionary reaction to be, to say the same word twice, would make me worry. You know, we've already had movies that are based around FaceTime and things like that, and Facebook. Are we going to have an Instagram movie coming out soon? That's all
probably
in that. It's hopefully no one's listening to this and gets an idea for that. But yeah, that would actually concern me, that actually there's going to be a push back the other way, and that a lot of things that maybe are better now, because I think some things are better. You know, the fact that we can point out, or that we can point out individual examples rather than say all films are like that, that would concern me that we go back the other way. And that everyone, you know, the male gaze becomes Dave Gurr again.
Yeah, well, I think what we really need to do is you know, is stop being so focused on social media and presenting ourselves in a certain way. And, you know, if I've got any advice for people, is, you know, take a break from it and try and don't feel pressure to put everything out there and to just, especially with young women, I know that there is a lot of pressure to look a certain way and be this a certain way. And I think the media really has to change in terms of what role models they are for young women. And I think that, you know, film is such a big part of our lives. Even if you don't go to the movies, even if you don't go to the cinema, you still consume movies, in whether it's on Netflix, Disney Plus, whatever your streaming platform of choice is, we still consume it somehow. And I think we need it reinforced in what we're watching in our content in order for us to change our behavior as well. It has to sort of, you know, it can't just be one-sided. We all need to, you know, advertisers as well, in terms of how, you know, Christmas is coming up. I'm sure we're going to have perfume adverts where it's, you know, like you say, it's going to be some woman and she's not going to be wearing very much, and then she's been going to be selling perfume, and it's like the advert's nothing to do with perfume. She never sprays it on herself. But we all sort of need to work together, and I think that's what we're doing with In Their Own League, is, you know, trying to, in our own little way, is tackle that and you know, bring attention to these sort of topics, and also bring the focus to female filmmakers and the work that they do. So not saying that we're going to fix the male gaze and change the world, but you know what I'm trying to say, right?
We can help a bit.
Yeah, we can all do our own little, in our own little bit, we can all make it improve and try and have show that there is more to cinema than just a male gaze. And I think, yeah, it's a big topic to cover, isn't it? It's like,
Certainly isn't an hour. We've barely scratched the surface. But I think we've acknowledged it's there. But I think the important thing to do is not just about where the camera's pointed.
No.
It's about why the camera's pointed and how we're consuming that camera as well.
Yeah. And I think we are seeing, you know, we're beginning to see more female-led films, which is great. And, you know, how they're being depicted, like you said, with Captain Marvel. I mean, whether you like that movie or not, what it was trying to do was, give a role model that isn't running around in, you know, thigh-high boots and...
And a bikini.
But yeah, any closing thoughts at all? No, that's great.
Our brains have emptied.
I think we did well. This went well for our first ever podcast. I mean, I'm definitely excited that we have the podcast launching. We've done really well with our site, and if you head over there, we are still doing our top 50 films of the decade countdown, top 50 films directed by a female filmmaker countdown, I should say. And there's been some really interesting movies that I don't necessarily agree that some of them should be on that list. I mean, Cloud Atlas, I still have problems with that movie, mostly because I have no idea what's going on in that film. But I think we have some really great content coming, you know, your way, and I'm very excited about it. I don't know about you two.
Me too.
Yay!
And I'm happy to be part of it as well, from a slightly different perspective.
Well, I think everybody deserves to be a part of it and have their voice heard. So I think if we're going to, you know, we've got to work together as a team, and everybody should be involved in their own way. And I think, you know, that's what I wanted when I set up In Their Own League, is a site that gives everybody a chance to talk and also promote women in film as well. Because, you know, why not? We need a sideline. Why not?
We do.
Well, I think that's why, rather than why not.
It's needed. It is needed. And have we got any plans for any films that we hope to be catching up with?
I can tell you about a film I watched last night, which I absolutely fell in love with, which was The Farewell.
Oh, my gosh.
Did you like that or not?
No, I'm super excited for it. I haven't had a chance to see it. It only showed for 2 days at my local theater.
Oh, my God. I mean, I'm a huge Awkwafina fan anyway. And she's obviously amazing. I'm an Asian cinema guy. But this is very much an American film, although most of it's set in China. And it's just, well, it's my film of the year. And I know I've got a month or so to go. But, yeah, really, really affecting, really well acted, and yeah, just fantastic.
Yeah, it's such a good movie. I just, it broke me, that film. It really did. But yeah, we'll have to see if it ends up on our list of the top 50 films of the decade. I can't say, maybe.
But spoilers?
Yeah. I will just say this. I won't tell you where it ended up on our list, okay? But it made the list. What about you, Kate? Are you watching anything or any films that you can recommend to listeners at home?
Well, currently I'm working on my retrospective of Yentl, which is directed by the glorious Barbara Streisand. And especially coming up to award season, it was the first... She was the first woman to win Best Director, and she's, I believe, still the only woman whose picture actually ended up winning Best Picture at the Golden Globes.
Yeah, I think you're right about that.
And first Jewish woman. So I'm working on watching that a bunch of times over and over to get like notes and stuff, annoying my family. But who gets tired of Barbara Streisand singing? Nobody. And young Mandy Patinkin. So, and then I'm excited to see movies coming out soon. I think Dark Waters is the next one I'm seeing, and have a Q&A, so that'll be fun.
Oh, nice. Wow. I'm really looking forward to your retrospective review, Yentl. I know it's going to be good.
Thank you.
And, you know, I think that's a movie that I need to revisit, even though I'm not... I'm not a huge fan of Barbra Streisand. but that's mostly because I don't like musicals, so
she sings in everything, so yeah. I think Funny Girl's probably the most watchable of her movies, but no, Yentl's a good one to watch. It's just to see, because her films always have a strong female character in them, and so I like, because it's really hard to make Barbara not a strong person in a movie. So I mean,
she's wonderful, like you said.
If you need a strong female character in a film and don't know what to watch, Barbara's usually a good bet.
Those both sound great. And I like I say, you know, always head over to our website for, and if you're stuck on what to watch, we've got some great films, you know, we're covering, and, you know, especially the top 50 films. There's probably some that have, you know, maybe flown under the radar, like you know, we're seeing a lot of best films of the decade countdowns, and yeah, there's certain films that should be on those lists and haven't made it, and that's why I wanted to do our list, which is I'm really excited about. I can't wait until we get to the number one spot. I know I won't spoil it. I won't spoil it, but just I'm just really excited about it. So yeah, I think this has been a good podcast, if I may say so myself.
It's fun.
Where can we find you both on Twitter?
My handle's at Captain Hangry. It's CAPT_Hangry. I'm on there all the time, so not hard to find.
I love the fact that it's Captain Hangry. It's wonderful.
It was a joke. It was a gamer tag for my Xbox because my brother was Sergeant something, so I had to outrank him, and I was like, what's an adjective that works for me? I was like, hangry, got it. And it's just stuck.
Oh, perfect. I love it. And what about yourself, Stephen?
You can find me at LPVO. I'm not even going to explain why that is. That was something from about 20 years ago that stuck. That's how old I am and how long I've been on Twitter and how little I understand it. But yes, if you want to find me there, or you can find me over at the Ocean Cinema Film Podcast. Yeah, whatever, club or whatever. Find me on Twitter. I'll link you.
We'll find you somehow. And of course,
I'll turn up gazing at something.
And of course, we can both find you over at intheirownleague.com. And and myself, you can find me at The Film B. My name's B. I like film. There you go. Simple. And like myself. And you could also find me chugging away at In Their Own League. The handle for our Twitter is Their League, because it wouldn't let me put In Their Own League due to like space or something. Anyway,
it's a conspiracy.
It
clearly.
Is clearly. But I really enjoyed having you both on this podcast episode, and we'll have to have you back on in the near future. If you would like to write in with any suggestions of topics that you would like us to cover, please do. You can always drop us a email at intheirownleague@gmail.com. You can also show your support over at Patreon, and there is exclusive content over there for yourselves to check out. And of course, you can follow us on Twitter. We just want to give a shout out to all our patrons and would like to thank them for their support. It really does mean quite a lot to us, and we would like to thank you for listening.